Let me recap on the story just briefly, and then I'll finish with just two simple points. So, as chapter 2 opens, the king's rage has subsided. And he comes to his senses, and he realizes that because he sacked his wife, now he doesn't have one. Nope. And having gone to his lawyers for advice with his self-inflicted personal problems in chapter 1, now it seems he goes to his young men for advice here. I mean, he is so pathetic. It seems like he can't even decide on his own when to use the restroom. He is a clown. And given the nature of his problem now, that he's missing his smoking hot ex-wife, going to the red-blooded young men for advice probably isn't the wisest choice. And so, very predictably, their cunning plan is basically a Miss World competition, followed by nightly auditions in the king's bedroom. And equally predictably, the king loves it. And so it begins. And then we cut to a new character, verse 5. Now there was a Jew in Susa the citadel whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Who cares? Why are we told that? Why are we being given Mordecai's genealogy? And there is a crucial reason. And it'll come in a few weeks' time. And when we see why, we will care deeply. So no spoilers yet. I'm afraid I'm going to leave you hanging just for a few weeks. But you've got to remember, Mordecai is in the family line of Kish. That's going to come back. That's going to be important. Then we meet Esther herself, verse 7. He, Mordecai, was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther. Now, Hadassah is her Jewish name. Hadassah literally means myrtle, as in the myrtle tree plant. And myrtle was a national symbol for Israel. And so Esther represents the entire nation of Israel in this story, as we're going to see. And then the name Esther is her Persian name, possibly forced on her by the empire, in which she's a defeated exile. And Esther literally means star. You can almost hear it in the name Esther, can't you? Esther, star. And star is what the Persians associated with things like fate and fortune and destiny. It's almost as if Esther was, I don't know, born for such a time as this. Anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. That's going to emerge in the coming chapters. But remember, star, okay, so fate, destiny. That's Esther. And according to verse 7, Esther is stunning. She is stunning. She's got this beautiful figure. She's beautiful to look at. And so she gets spotted. And she gets included in this roundup across the empire. And she finds herself forcibly enrolled in the Royal School of Beauty, the Royal Academy of Beauticians. And she makes the call to keep quiet about her faith, at least for now, her faith in the one true God. And that's probably for her safety. She's told that by her cousin Mordecai, her adoptive father. And anyway, she quickly rises to the top of the class, and 1 year later, after an entire year-long course of these extravagant beauty treatments, can just imagine her with the white dressing gown and the cucumbers on the eyes, and a year of that, her night finally arrives. Verse 16, and when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, so that pins this down for us historically, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. It's to celebrate that he has a new king. And the story goes a bit further at the end of the chapter when Mordecai discovers a plot to assassinate the king, and we'll come to that later. But what do we make with what I said earlier was a pretty sordid, at times gross, tale? And it's very strange, isn't it? At first glance, the author doesn't seem to be taking any sides, drawing any lessons out for us. God doesn't apparently get a look in the same way he doesn't seem to for the whole book. which we thought about last week. So what do we do with this? Well, this narrative is in fact incredibly rich. And as we reflect on it now, and I just pull out a few more of the details and explain their significance, I think we'll see that the story is very cleverly, very powerfully communicating to us a couple of critical, life-changing truths. Like I said at the start, I've got 2 points. Just before I share the first, and before that slide comes up for the first, we need to think a bit more deeply about the king. When the young man hatched their plan for the king, what is it they appeal to? Have a look again at verse 4. Esther chapter 2, verse 4. Do you see what they appeal to? What they're driven by? Answer, what pleases the king? Except if you look more closely, that's not quite what they say, is it? Now look at the footnote 2 in verse 4. And you'll see this in ESV translations of the Bible. It's the closest literally to the original language. It's what I recommend for us to be on the same page with here on Sunday mornings. Literally, according to the Hebrew there, the young men appeal to what is good in the eyes of the king. And that theme of things being judged by how they look runs throughout this chapter. It's all about things being assessed and judged by their external physical appearance. So look at verse 7. Esther's described as lovely to look at. Verse 15, she said to win favor in the eyes of all who see her. Verse 17, she's said to win grace and favor in the king's sight. And what's important, say the young men back in verse 2, is that these virgins are young and beautiful. Now, they don't say how young, 18, 16, 14. The point is that they've got to be flawless. They've got to be good to look at. Beautiful young virgins come again and are mentioned again in verse 3. Then we get cosmetics in verse 3, Esther's beautiful figure, verse 7, to look at. Cosmetics again in verse 9, a whole year of cosmetics in verse 12, and so on all throughout the chapter. Do you get the theme that the emphasis here on what things look like externally, then being judged and assessed on how you see them? Now, I hope we would say that's pretty shallow, isn't it? You know, don't judge a book by its cover, we say. Character matters more than looks. True beauty's on the inside. And I hope that's what we're modeling to our children, communicating to our spouses, training those who look up to us in. That's not how King Ahasuerus rolls. And it gets much, much worse. Not only is he just that shallow and lustful, he's greedy and acquisitive with it. He sees, he wants, he takes. Halfway through verse 8, Esther was taken into the king's palace. Start of verse 16, Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus. Where it gets really gross and sad, and I need to be honest about this, without being distasteful and gratuitously explicit, is verse 14. Look at verse 14. And I need to build this argument, which I've nearly done doing now, for us to make sense of the first point. Verse 14. In the evening, she, whoever the woman was for that night after her year of preparation, would go in to spend the night with the king, that is, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So basically, it's like he's built this huge collection of living dolls. Thousands of them. We'll do a little bit of math later. And they're a certain kind of doll, if you know what I mean. And it's an endless parade of these dolls for his personal pleasure. And so he tries them out one by one, and then they're disposed of. They can't go home, can't go back to their families, they can't marry. They languish for the rest of their lives in this second harem, which is basically the discard pile. Shallow, lustful, compulsive, greedy, acquisitive, exploitative, cruel. He's a monster, isn't he? Well, now we're ready for my first point. So let's have the first slide. We've got to think about the king in us. We're quick to point to Ahasuerus as being a disgusting loser, and we're not wrong to. But if we're being really honest, we will actually be able to see even just a little bit of that same DNA in our hearts. Human nature. History doesn't record exactly how many women the king chewed his way through. We do know from chapters 1 and 2 that about 4 years, like I said at the start, elapse between him sacking Queen Vashti and picking Queen Esther. Let's say he ran his scheme for not all, but maybe most of those 4 years. Let's say he took at least an occasional night off. I did the math. That is around 1,100 women. I said thousands earlier. That's exaggerating. I'm sorry. About 1,100 minimum, I would say. That is the same number as the number of naked images on average seen by a child today by the time they're 18 years old. 1,100. According to the American Healthcare Organization, FHE Health, 90% of children aged 6 to 18 have viewed pornography, 90%. 70% of men aged 18 to 34 use pornography at least once a month. 1 in 6 women struggle with pornography addiction. $10 to $14 billion a year are spent annually on pornography. That is the same amount that the US government spends on foreign aid. And so I'm very confident that there must be a significant number of us struggling with pornography. And this isn't, like, I haven't just discovered this last week. Like, pastors know about this. This has been the case for years and years and years. And I don't see how I can't bring it up and be honest about it when we're in this passage. Look at King Ahasuerus. We're not maybe quite as different as we would hope. And so if that is you, I'm assuming a significant proportion of that is us. If that is you, please, please get help. There are some great Christian resources online. Maybe start with an organization called Covenant Eyes. Just search that. But there are other good ones too. And summon up the courage to grab me afterwards over lunch or drop me a text. I'd love to come alongside you and help you and pray with you, pray for you. If you're female, I'd love to put you in touch with a woman who can do the same. And you might say, well, pornography is not the same as King Ahasuerus. It is the same in principle. When we get sucked into it, we exercise exactly the same shallow, lustful, compulsive, exploitative impulses that he had. It's human nature. We just don't have the opportunities he had in how we express it. It's one of the big differences here. We just don't have his freedom and power and opportunities. But in fact, the pornography industry today chews up and spits out women in a way that makes King Ahasuerus look like a good social worker. And I could show that right now. I won't get into it, but I could show it using the latest stats for mental health, physical health, abuse, and suicide among sex workers. Pornography is never free. That's an oxymoron. And using it fuels that industry that makes King Ahasuerus look like a good guy. And that is nothing to the worst thing about pornography. The worst thing is that it dishonors God. And that's not just pornography. That's any kind of sexual immorality. Like all sin, sexual immorality, like all sin, declares war on him. It declares war on what he has clearly laid out as the safest, best, most joy-giving use of his amazing, good gift of sex. Regarding pornography, one pastor describes it like this. And tell me if this isn't or is King Ahasuerus. Quote, Here, I'm provided on the internet with this endless string of women who cannot object, who cannot speak back, who must do my will, who I can use, abuse, discard, and then move on to the next. They cannot say no. They cannot say no. I'm the powerful one. There is something of the king in all of us, and it's called sin. And we're not one of those churches weirdly obsessed with pornography or sexual sin, and if you attend over a period of months, you would pick that up. We're just against sin as a whole. And sin, in essence, comes down to living for ourselves instead of our rightful king. So this, like I say, this isn't even just about sexual immorality. If we extend the principle, this is any way in which we live for ourselves instead of our rightful God. We're fools to look down on King Ahasuerus without recognizing that same principle, that same dysfunction in our own hearts, at least in principle, even if it looks different in practice. Now, maybe for you it's not pornography. Fine. But we all have some of the king in us in one way or another. It's in our nature. As Romans 3:23 says that we heard earlier this service, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Let me ask a quick question. How do you think a worm gets into an apple? Eats its way in, right? That's what I thought too. Until recently, I discovered that actually what happens normally is that the insect lays an egg in the apple blossom, and much later, the worm hatches in the heart of the apple and eats its way out. Sin works its way out through our thoughts and words and actions. Fundamentally, it's part of our human nature. It's in our hearts. The heart of the human problem is the problem of the human heart. And so maybe we're not quite as different from the king as we might have wanted to assume. Which brings me finally to the good news. Second and final point, let's think about now the king for us. We've thought about the king in us, try to be honest, but let's now consider the king for us. We've just taken a closer look at King Ahasuerus. Let's now take a closer look at Esther. First of all, did you notice how weak she is? Yes, she's beautiful, but first of all, she's female, so she's viewed as a second-class citizen right off the bat. She's been orphaned as a youngster, and so she's been adopted. Verse 7, I think God has a special place for, well, he explicitly says he has a special place for widows and orphans. And if you trace the line of how God uses kids who are adopted through Scripture, that is a fascinating thread to pull. Anyway, Esther's one of them. She finds herself a despised member of the Jewish people in a massive, hostile, pagan, powerful empire. And fourth, she's a helpless victim of this empire. She's brutally taken in verse 8, if you remember, and taken in verse 16, as the ruler does what he likes with her. Weak, 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 weak. Now, does that remind you of anyone? Because years after this, there was another Jew, and he was also viewed as a second-class citizen, and he was also adopted, at least by his earthly father. And he was also a despised member of the Jewish people in a massive, hostile, powerful pagan nation, a pagan empire. And he was also apparently a helpless victim, brutally taken by his enemies, the rulers of the day. And they did what they wanted with him. Quick spoiler, by the end of the book, Esther will have saved her people. But what enables her to do that is the fact that she's queen. And what enables her to be queen is the fact of this one night with the king, when she endures horrible wickedness at the hands of the one who seems to have power over her. That is exactly, that doesn't that point so uncannily to our king? He saved his people by enduring horrible wickedness at the hands of the ones who seemed to have power over him as they stripped him and beat him and nailed him to that cross. And what a king he is. King Ahasuerus loved his bride because she was beautiful. King Jesus loved his people, who the Bible calls his bride, when she wasn't beautiful. Romans 5:8 says that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. King Ahasuerus loved his bride because she was beautiful. King Jesus' love for his bride is what makes her beautiful. Ephesians 5:26 speaks of him sanctifying her, cleansing her, washing her through the water of the word to present her in splendor without blemish or spot or wrinkle. King Ahasuerus chose his bride on a transactional basis. To be accepted by him, she had to meet a standard. King Jesus chose his bride on an unconditional, not a transactional, but an unconditional basis. To be accepted by him, we have to admit that we cannot meet the standard. King Ahasuerus made his bride give herself up for him. King Jesus gave himself up for his bride. Ephesians 5 again, Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. And when King Ahasuerus felt let down by his bride, whether it was Queen Vashti or any of the other tryouts who he then tossed onto the discard pile, that's what he did with them. Whereas King Jesus says to his bride, in the words of Hebrews 13, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. King Ahasuerus stands for the way of this world. And there are lots of Ahasueruses running around. Like, it's human nature. There but for the grace of God go we. And we still have our struggles. And maybe you've been in relationships like that. Maybe you've felt loved, and then it turned out when you became less beautiful or performed less well that was a surface thing only, and then you felt left on the discard pile. Well, King Jesus offers a different way. Is he your king? And if he is, are you consciously enjoying him, fighting to stay close to him, appreciating him, actually walking with him through your life? Are you living for him? 1 Peter 2:11 tells us that, like Esther, we are exiles in this world as followers of Christ, that this world isn't our home, just like the Persian Empire wasn't for Esther and Mordecai. Romans 12:2 tells us not to conform to the pattern of this world. Well, the more deeply we come to see our King for who he is, what he's like, the more we'll love him. And the more we love him, the more we'll want to live for him instead of for this world. None of us live perfectly for the King. That's the point of grace and the true gospel. But it should spur us to ask, if we have accepted him as our husband, our King, what needs to change in our lives?